Good morning, everybody. I want to start by saying Steph, Harley, Bianca, that was a truly special song. Truly special. In 1988, I was fresh out of college. I was at my first job as a computer programmer, and I had a newly minted manager whose name was Lori. And I was her first report. And she asked me to do a task, and she asked me to do it in a particular way, and I thought it would take about a week, which was fine with her. But when I went back to my desk, I figured out a clever way to do it that would take about 2 hours and have a lot less risk. And this is what we in my industry call a hack. Though we don't always mean that negatively. This was a clever hack. So I went back to her and I proposed doing it this other way, but she was not impressed, and she still asked me to do it her way. I went back to my desk and I felt a bit frustrated about this, and there were only a few hours left in the day, so I thought I would give my hack a try. And it worked quite well. And I went home and I stewed about the situation all evening. And even started writing up some justification. And the next morning I met with Lori, and I told her I was really sure my way would work, but she doubted me. And then I said, but I tried it already and it worked. And she got very upset at me and insisted that I do it her way. So I went back, I started working on it her way. It took about 3 days, not the full week. And, marginally faster than I expected. But the damage had been done in my relationship with Lori. All of our conversations after that were uncomfortable, and she clearly considered me a problematic employee. Fortunately, after a month or so, she left with her fiancé to the Greek islands, lived happily ever after, and was never heard from again. And I got a new manager named Eric. So fast forward a couple months. Eric assigns me a task, and he asked me to do it in a particular way. And when we talked about it, I told him I thought that there was going to be something about the operating system that would make it his way impossible to work. But I had this clever idea that I think I would be able to do it in about 2 hours. And he got this knowing smile on his face. And I realized right then, he knew all about what had happened between me and Lori, and here it was happening again. What to do? What to do? I was a new employee in need of advice. Fortunately, in the time between those two incidents, I had gotten some good advice, and in the years since, I've collected other bits of good advice that I plan to share today. Now, I actually first gave this sermon 15 years ago in 2004 when we were still in the old building. But everyone from Josh's age on down would have been in Bible fun class, and some of them are now joining the workforce for the full time. So I figure, and honestly, 15 years is long enough for people like me to forget. So I figure it's time to give it again. And most of this advice that I'm giving comes from two sources. The first is my number one hero in the Bible, the patriarch Joseph. And the second is from a modern day Joseph, my grandfather Dean Rusk. Now, many of you, but not all, will know that my grandfather Dean was Secretary of State for Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And he had other positions prior to that that were formative to his character and his experience. Most notably among them was that he reported to General George C. Marshall. Marshall was the chief of staff of the U.S. Army in World War II and was widely considered the architect of the victory over Nazi Germany. He was then Secretary of State for President Truman, where he spearheaded the plan to rebuild war-torn Europe that eventually became known as the Marshall Plan, for which he received the Nobel Prize. My grandfather considered General Marshall to be the greatest American of the 20th century. And some of this advice effectively comes from General Marshall. But what made my grandfather a modern-day Joseph was that he was born in what we today would call poverty in the hardscrabble hills of Cherokee County, Georgia, on an unproductive farm, and he rose to become the right-hand man to two presidents of the most powerful country in the world, and was himself fourth in the line of succession. But this is a sermon in a church, so we're going to start with Joseph. Now, Dave covered much of Joseph's story in late November and early December. So I'm just going to give some very highly edited highlights relevant to job advice. Joseph is born in his father's old age and is the favorite son to the annoyance of his older brothers. Joseph has two dreams that he shares with his family with very little humility. The first suggests that his brothers will all bow down to him someday. The second suggests that his brothers and his mother and father will all bow down to him. And this makes his brothers very jealous. We pick the story up in Genesis 37, verse 18. I'll be reading from the New Living Translation today. When Joseph's brothers saw him coming, they recognized him in the distance and made plans to kill him. But Reuben said, "Let's just throw him alive into this pit here. That way he will die without our having to touch him." So when Joseph arrived, they pulled off his beautiful robe and threw him into the pit. So his brothers beat him up and leave him exposed to the elements. No food and water. Time passes. What is Joseph thinking during this time? Is it possible that he finally humbles himself before God there? We often talk about a metaphorical pit that someone needs to be in before we humble ourselves before God. I remember the father of a high school soccer friend of mine who got into a pit of financial ruin before he turned to God. But Joseph here is in a literal pit, an actual hole in the ground that may even hold like garbage and other stuff worse than garbage. The events that follow highly suggest that Joseph reaches out to God in desperation at this moment while contemplating his death at the hands of his brothers. Continuing on, Genesis 37, verse 25. Then just as they were sitting down to eat, they noticed a caravan of camels in the distance coming towards them. It was a group of Ishmaelite traders going to Egypt. When the traders came by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the pit and sold him for 20 pieces of silver, and the Ishmaelite traders took him along to Egypt. So his brothers decide to make a buck off of him. But notice, Joseph lives. Genesis 39. Now when Joseph arrived in Egypt with the Ishmaelite traders, he was purchased by Potiphar, a member of the personal staff of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Potiphar was the captain of the palace guard. So Joseph is sold into slavery, and it seems the promise of his dreams is snuffed out. Yet notice, he is sold to the captain of the palace guard, not to some run-of-the-mill landowner. God is already at work. The Lord was with Joseph and blessed him greatly as he served in the home of his Egyptian master. Potiphar noticed this and realized that the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything he did. So Joseph naturally became quite a favorite with him. Potiphar soon put Joseph in charge of his entire household and entrusted him with all his business dealings. From the day Joseph was put in charge, the Lord began to bless Potiphar for Joseph's sake. All his household affairs began to run smoothly and his crops and livestock flourished. So Potiphar gave Joseph complete administrative responsibility over everything he owned. With Joseph there, he didn't have a worry in the world except to decide what he wanted to eat. Potiphar notices the blessings of God on Joseph as he works diligently and obediently for Potiphar. So this leads to the first two fill-ins on your sheet. Number one, ask for God's blessing in all that you do at work. And skip down to number four. honor and obey those in authority over you, as Joseph did to Potiphar. So you'll notice I skipped a few points. I've actually listed them on your sheets in a more natural order to look at them later in case there's any value in reviewing them. So as Joseph works himself with Potiphar and shows himself faithful with the task he's given, Potiphar entrusts Joseph with more responsibilities in areas where he could be most effective. So point number five, don't expect trust until you've earned it. Don't expect trust until you've earned it. And along these lines, does any passage from the New Testament come to mind? Anyone? What, Joe? There you go, exactly. Jesus' parable of the talents, where he says, he who is faithful with little will be faithful with much, or will be entrusted with much. Finally, Joseph is elevated to the highest possible position in Potiphar's household. I do want to note here that we should honor those in authority over us and earn their trust, etc., not because of what we gain from that attitude, but because it is right. It is what God wants us to do. Nonetheless, these attitudes tend to lead to advancement in most workplaces unless they're wildly dysfunctional. So Potiphar becomes entirely successful as a result of Joseph working for him. And that's point number six on your outlines. Seek to make those in authority over you successful. Seek out their success, not so much your own success. There's an important progression that Joseph experienced here, and this is listed on the bottom of your pages. Joseph was faithful, which was noticed, so he was entrusted with more, leading to him being elevated, making him and his boss successful. Faithful, noticed, entrusted, elevated, successful. So Joseph is now Potiphar's right-hand man, living large in his household. Life is relatively good for Joseph. What could possibly go wrong? Genesis 39:7. And about this time, Potiphar's wife began to desire him and invited him to sleep with her. But Joseph refused. He told her, "My master trusts me with everything in his entire household. He has held back nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I ever do such a wicked thing? It would be a great sin against God." And then she effectively frames him for rape. When her husband came home that night, she told him her story. "That Hebrew slave you had around has here tried to make a fool of me," she said, "and I was saved only by my screams." And after hearing his wife's story, Potiphar was furious. He took Joseph and threw him into the prison where the king's prisoners were held. So Potiphar's wife attempts to seduce Joseph, but he remains faithful to Potiphar and to God. So once again, he's unjustly accused and imprisoned. What is he thinking now? Was it all for naught? Does he remember his dreams and think how far he is now from them ever coming true? Yet even now, notice that Joseph is thrown into the jail where the king's prisoners are held. We actually learn later that this jail is in Potiphar's palace, almost as if Potiphar doesn't want Joseph too far away from him. And watch what happens. Genesis 39:21. But the Lord was with Joseph there too, and he granted Joseph favor with the chief jailer. Before long, the jailer put Joseph in charge of all the other prisoners and over everything that happened in the prison. The chief jailer had no more worries after that because Joseph took care of everything. The Lord was with him, making everything run smoothly and successfully. It took Joseph only one verse to be put in charge of the jail. I mean, think of the implications of that. I put them in point number two on your outline. Accept your job situations, including setbacks, without grumbling. If Joseph had stewed in jail, grumbling about the injustice of being thrown in there and wallowing in his sorrows, he would not have so quickly risen once again to prominence. But he doesn't stew. He gets to work. And notice here, once again, the same pattern as before. Faithful, noticed, entrusted, elevated, successful. Genesis 40. Sometime later, Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and chief baker offended him. Pharaoh became very angry with these officials, and he put them in the prison where Joseph was, in the palace of Potiphar, the captain of the guard. They remained in prison for quite some time, and Potiphar assigned Joseph to take care of them. One night, the cupbearer and the baker each had a dream, and each dream had its own meaning. The next morning, Joseph noted the dejected look on their faces. "Why do you look so worried today?" he asked. And they replied, "We both had dreams last night, but there's no one here to tell us what they mean." "Interpreting dreams is God's business," Joseph replied. "Tell me what you saw." And then Joseph then interprets the dreams of his fellow prisoners. This is point number 12. Assist your colleagues whenever possible. This reminds me of an anecdote from my grandfather's early life when he was in college. Well, he went to Davidson College in North Carolina, and he paid for school by working full-time at a community bank. The teller who was there was an elderly gentleman who also collected the local poll tax of $1. Now, Dean was a Georgia resident, so he didn't have to pay the poll tax, but he paid it regularly out of friendship and camaraderie with this elderly colleague of his. Well, years later, my grandfather was before the North Carolina Review Board seeking a nomination for a Rhodes Scholarship. His academic credentials were stellar at that point. He was a strong basketball player, which met the athletic requirement of scholarships back then. But an ornery member of the board leaned forward and said, "Rusk, why should we give a Rhodes Scholarship for North Carolina to a Georgia boy?" So Dean talked about his years at Davidson, serving the community, working at the bank, and happened to mention that he paid the poll tax. And when they heard this, they started and their objections melted away and they selected him. And Dean always said it was the best dollar he ever invested. "Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days." Ecclesiastes 11:1. Another form of casting your bread in the workplace is to mentor junior coworkers. I don't have any anecdotes from Dean or Joseph's life, but it bears mentioning. It's point number 13 on your outline. Seek to mentor and be mentored. I have twice been hired by someone that I mentored earlier in my career. Pressing on with Joseph, his interpretations of the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker come true, to the delight of the first and the demise of the second. But Joseph remains in jail for 2 more years. Then Pharaoh has a dream, and his magicians and wise men cannot interpret it. The cupbearer then finally remembers Joseph. Genesis 41:9. "Today I have been reminded of my failure," he said. "Some time ago, you were angry with the chief baker and me, and you imprisoned us in the palace of the captain of the guard. One night, the chief baker and I each had a dream, and each dream had a meaning. We told the dreams to a young Hebrew man who was a servant of the captain of the guard. He told us what each of our dreams meant, and everything happened just as he said it would." Pharaoh sent for Joseph at once, and he was brought hastily from the dungeon. Joseph's brief assistance to the cupbearer leads to his release from prison 2 years later. In 1941, my grandfather was training with his unit in the Pacific Northwest as the war was building, and it was looking increasingly likely that the U.S. would enter the war. And one day, as he was passing the office of his commanding officer, the officer shouted out to him, "Rusk! Do you know where Bhutan is?" And always a geography buff, my grandfather did. Well, when the war broke out, on the day his unit was going to ship out, Dean received orders reassigning him to Washington, D.C. as a Southeast Asian expert. And it was all based on that one answer to his commander's question. In fact, when he was shown the collected intelligence that the U.S. government had thus far in Southeast Asia, it was just a drawer with magazine clippings collected by a secretary. Dean's unit was shipped out without him to the Pacific Theater, and they all were later captured and perished in the infamous Bataan Death March. Dean never forgot how that question's answer saved his life. Genesis 41, verse 14. After a quick shave and change of clothes, Joseph went in and stood in Pharaoh's presence. "I had a dream last night," Pharaoh told him, "and none of these men can tell me what it means. But I have heard that you can interpret dreams, and that is why I have called for you." "It is beyond my power to do this," Joseph replied, "but God will tell you what it means and will set you at ease." Joseph correctly gives honor to God for his talent, as he also did to the baker and the cupbearer, you may have noticed. Point number 11, be quick to acknowledge blame, but slow to seek praise. That is a point I have applied many times throughout my career, and I can't remember any time where acknowledging blame has hurt me professionally. It gives you respect is what it does. In fact, you should be quick to deflect praise to others, particularly God, as Joseph did here and earlier with the baker and the cupbearer. 41:24. So Pharaoh told him the dream, and we know these dreams. There were seven fat cows, and then seven starving cows ate them, but the starving cows didn't get any fatter, and then seven withered stalks ate seven fat stalks. And he finished by saying, "I told these dreams to my magicians, but not one of them could tell me what they mean." Both dreams mean the same thing, Joseph told Pharaoh. God was telling you what he is about to do. The seven fat cows and the seven plump heads of grain both represent 7 years of prosperity. The seven thin, ugly cows and the seven withered heads of grain represent 7 years of famine. This will happen just as I have described it, for God has shown you what he is about to do. The next 7 years will be a period of great prosperity throughout the land of Egypt. But afterward, there will be 7 years of famine, so great that all the prosperity will be forgotten and wiped out. Famine will destroy the land. This famine will be so terrible that even the memory of the good years will be erased. As for having the dream twice, it means that the matter has been decreed by God and that he will make these events happen soon. By interpreting these dreams, Joseph met Pharaoh's deepest need and identifies a coming problem. But importantly, he doesn't just leave it at that. If he stops there, we probably wouldn't have ever heard the story. Genesis 41:33. "My suggestion is that you find the wisest man in Egypt and put him in charge of a nationwide program. Let Pharaoh appoint officials over the land and let them collect one-fifth of all the crops during the 7 good years. Have them gather all the food and grain of these good years into the royal storehouses and store it away so there will be food in the cities. That way there will be enough to eat when the 7 years of famine come. Otherwise, disaster will surely strike the land and all the people will die." Joseph suggests a solution to the problem. And that's point number 7 on your outlines. When raising a problem, always propose a solution. Not long after World War II finished, Dean was once again working for General George Marshall, who was now the Secretary of State. Dean was on duty at 1 a.m. in the morning when an eyes-only cable came in for General Marshall about Palestine. Dean read the cable and wrote up 2 possible responses to it, including his recommendations about which one to choose. He woke Marshall at 4 a.m. and presented him the cable and the possible responses. Marshall took it all in, chose a response, and then turned to my grandfather and said, "Rusk, there are times I think you earn your pay." Joseph's suggestions were well received by Pharaoh and his advisors. As they discussed who should be appointed for the job, Pharaoh said, "Who could do it better than Joseph? For he is a man who is obviously filled with the Spirit of God." Turning to Joseph, Pharaoh said, "Since God has revealed the meaning of the dreams to you, you are the wisest man in the land. I hereby appoint you to direct this project. You will manage my household and organize all my people. Only I will have a rank higher than yours." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I hereby put you in charge of the entire land of Egypt." So Joseph was put in charge of all Egypt. Joseph is acknowledged as wise and elevated to the highest position. As a former colleague of mine used to say, the cream always rises to the top. Now, to be honest, I have to acknowledge that this is a very premature decision by a young pharaoh based on one solid first impression. But it works out for him. Sure enough, for the next 7 years, there were bumper crops everywhere. During those years, Joseph took a portion of all the crops grown in Egypt and stored them for the government in nearby cities. After 7 years, the granaries were filled to overflowing. There was so much grain, like sand on the seashore, that the people could not keep track of the amount. At last, the 7 years of plenty came to an end. Then the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had predicted. There were crop failures in all the surrounding countries too, but in Egypt there was plenty of grain in the storehouses. Throughout the land of Egypt, the people began to starve. They pleaded with Pharaoh for food, and he told them, "Go to Joseph and do whatever he tells you." So with severe famine everywhere in the land, Joseph opened up the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians. And people from surrounding lands also came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe throughout the world. So Joseph executes on the plan, and he makes Pharaoh wildly successful. In fact, he makes Pharaoh uncomfortably successful by modern standards. We learn in chapter 47 that all of Egypt is reduced to serving Pharaoh, including a 20% tax on all crops in perpetuity. But notice, once again, faithful, noticed, entrusted, elevated, successful. Now, at this point in the story, Joseph's brothers come to Egypt to get grain for their family, and they don't recognize him. Joseph puts them through various situations to test their attitudes, to see what they've learned over the years. And then he arranges a private meeting to reveal himself to them. Genesis 45, verse 3. "I am Joseph," he said to his brothers, but his brothers were speechless. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there right in front of them. "Come over here," he said. So they came closer, and he said again, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But don't be angry with yourselves that you did this to me, for God did it. He sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. God has sent me here to keep you and your families alive so that you will become a great nation. Yes, it was God who sent me here, not you. And he has made me a counselor to Pharaoh, manager of his entire household, and ruler over all Egypt." Joseph recognizes that God has been with him throughout all of his misfortunes. God has been using his harsh circumstances to create job situations to save his family's lives. This is point number 3 on your outlines. Recognize that God can use any job situation you are in to improve your character, to affect the lives of your colleagues, and to advance you in unexpected ways. Amen. All right, so I opened with the anecdote about my first manager, Lori, that went so poorly. And I started another anecdote with my second manager, Eric, that was shaping up along the same lines. So, do you want to know what happened?
Yes.
All right, because if you said no, it would have really ruined my pace here. Eric asked me to go back to my desk and prepare a list of pros and cons about both ways of doing it, his way and my way. So I did this. I came back and I presented him the list. And it wasn't a very balanced list. So he asked me to go back and find more pros about his way and more cons about my way. So I worked really hard. I did that. I presented it all to him. And he decided that we should try it his way. So I started working on the task. And I pretty quickly ran into the technical roadblock that I thought would prevent his way from working. But I persevered to see if I could get past it. I read manuals. I looked up the source code for the operating system on microfiche. Does anyone remember microfiche? But this technical problem was insurmountable. So I met with Eric again, and I presented my findings. He looked over it silently for what seemed like hours, and then said to me, "Okay, let's do it your way." So I went back to my desk, implemented my idea in 2 hours, and it worked. We met again, and he congratulated me for getting it working. And he and I went on to have a great working relationship for the 3 years that I remained out in Amherst before I moved to Boston. I got assigned the hardest, most interesting tasks, and I was given significant leeway to try some pretty bold solutions to them. And key to the difference between those two anecdotes were 2 points. The first one is number 8. Argue your point until a decision is made, then support that decision wholeheartedly. That advice was a cornerstone of my grandfather's attitude in serving Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. He believed that the presidential need to make final decisions, having no one else in the world to pass the buck onto, was a heavy burden, but one that the American people elected that particular man to bear. Dean felt that his own responsibility was to help the president make the best decision possible, but to support the decision made, even if it went against his own advice. In particular, he never publicly voiced disagreement with policy decisions, even on such disastrous things as the Bay of Pigs invasion that he was very much against. His commitment to that ideal extended so far that he decided to never write his memoirs, since tragically neither man would be around to defend themselves. It took over 20 years for his son Richard, my uncle, to convince Dean to finally tell his story in the book As I Saw It, and it's a fantastic book, well worth reading, if you can get your hands on a copy. I happen to notice there's a bunch of used ones on Amazon. The second point that was different between my two anecdotes was the following. Number 9, never say, "I told you so." That is one of the worst things that you can say in a working relationship, or a marriage for that matter. If I had crowed to Eric that I was right from the start, all of the goodwill I gained would have been lost. He knew at the end that my way was better than his, but I didn't need to point that out to him. Both my fervent efforts to try his way and my refusal to crow about the success of my way led to the respect that he developed for me and the great working relationship we had after that. I have 2 more anecdotes to finish filling out your sheets. In 1950, Dean was working at the United Nations desk in the State Department when the Assistant Secretary for Far Eastern Affairs fell victim to Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist purges of communist sympathizers. Seeing the urgency of that post going unfilled, Dean volunteered for the position, even though it represented a demotion for him. 4 months later, North Korean troops poured across the 38th parallel into South Korea, starting the Korean War. And in his new position, Dean was well positioned to influence events over the next few years as the Korean War started. So that's point number 10, volunteer for the hard and unpopular jobs. And then finally, I have this encouragement from an anecdote in my own career. Point number 14, remain open for business at all times. The other advice I've shared thus far allows you to model the character of Christ and of a Christian to your coworkers. If you do those, you will earn opportunities to talk about Christ and be heard by them. A woman named Chris was my manager on my final project at an internet consulting company called Primex during the heady days of the internet bubble, 1999 going into 2000. We were super busy on this project, and she was under a lot of pressure, experiencing daily difficulties with both the client and our own management, including numerous arguments. One day she closed the door to the room we were in and said, "Why aren't you as upset about all this as I am?" And I replied, "Times like this make me thankful that Jesus teaches us to forgive others." And we didn't have a full gospel discussion right on the spot, but it helped put her at ease. And we were able to come up with some constructive ideas for how to resolve some of the problems. A few days later, she came into the room again and said, "Tell me again about that forgiving people stuff." And we ended up talking about it a number of times through the end of the project. Christians should be standout workers in their workplaces. The principles of Scripture and the models we have in people like Joseph, and I'll mention that Daniel's another very good one, should enable us to shine as lights to our coworkers and bosses. So take these principles to heart and live them. Faithful, noticed, entrusted, elevated, successful. Amen.